Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. Your expectations can have a surprising effect on the people around you. And on the newest Invisibilia, you'll hear from neuroscientists who explain the profound effect others' expectations can have on your physiology, and from the blind man who says expectations have helped him see. From some of the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now. The new episode drops January 23rd. And that's the kicky music that means it is time for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll take a look at Comedy Central's offbeat Broad City, which finds two women in New York with a lot of guest stars and a lot of pot and sometimes not a lot of underwear. Then we'll talk about the concept of required reading, the books we had to read, the choices we made and never got to make, and what it all means to us now. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And it's a very exciting week for us here at Pop Culture Happy Hour. Joining us from the great city of Boston, here to share her thoughts on books and lots more, one of our favorite book people, Miss Margaret H. Willison. Margaret, up in Boston, what is it that you do?
For love and money, I'm a librarian. And for love alone, I guess I host the best 24/7 slumber party on Twitter.
This is my favorite description of you. I think it is perfectly apt. We're enormously happy that you could join us from all the way up there in Boston. It's just like having you here.
Right, and for me, it's just like talking with my three imaginary friends.
Nice.
That's how we like to think of ourselves.
I actually am one of your imaginary friends.
It's true. So this week, we wanted to talk about Broad City. Now, I want to go to Stephen to set this up a little bit. Stephen, you were recently in New York for an event. Can you talk a little bit about that event?
Yeah, by the time this podcast comes out, it will be available to be watched on video for everyone. I got to introduce an event at New York City's Ace Hotel last Friday, the 16th, in which the women of Broad City, Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer, interviewed the three members of the band Sleater-Kinney, whose first album in more than 8 years, No Cities to Love, came out this week. And so it was this wonderful confluence of this fresh comedy show and this wonderful, incredibly important band coming together and doing this loose and funny and weird and occasionally off the rails panel discussion that I got to very briefly be a very quick part of. And my goal was to get up there, get off the stage as quickly as humanly possible, and then be forgotten. So mission accomplished as far as that was concerned. I mean, my real goal was to have an excuse to attend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I will add as a side point before we get to Broad City, if you have not seen Sleater-Kinney performing on David Letterman recently, they performed. And what I will tell you about that performance, if you have not yet seen it, and please let this send you running to the internet. Our friend Carrie Brownstein, Carrie's pantsuit game is on point on David Letterman. It is for real, no kidding, on point.
She decided to stand down for this event. She is not, she's not pantsuit clad, but
yeah.
She's awesome.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to lead with that is to try to acknowledge off the top that one of the things that has gone on with Broad City is that, you know, it's one of the executive producers is Amy Poehler. It is one of a relatively small number of comedies that is centered around young women, and it takes its place kind of awkwardly next to and adjacent to Girls, mm-hmm. has been compared to it in certain ways favorably by some people and I'm sure unfavorably by other people.
Well, and sensibly in some ways and nonsensically in others.
Absolutely. It is Friends living in New York. I have to say, I saw, to me, the funniest comment the other day that sort of said, well, what really bothers me is when people say that Girls is some kind of universal story of women in New York City. That's not a universal story of women in New York City. This is a universal story of women in New York City. And I'm just like, there is no universe. Give me a break. So it is kind of taking on some of that same baggage of trying to fill a really big void. I'm going to start with our pal, Margaret. Margaret, are you a Broad City fan?
I am a huge Broad City fan, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm today's token youth.
The closest thing there
the
to.
The closest thing that you guys can get. Farthest from the decrepit bones. It's true. Farthest from the grave, closest to the cradle. I love Broad City. When I was actually the age of the characters on Broad City, your options for shows about female friendship were like Sex in the City or nothing, which is why I've watched all of Sex in the City. And now there are a lot more options to choose from, and Broad City is definitely my poison of preference because, unlike Girls, the biggest difference for me is the characters all seem to like each other.
Right.
Yeah.
And you understand why they like each other, and you just kind of live in them super appreciating each other the entire time you're watching the show. Yeah. And it's so much fun. It just feels really warm.
Even when it's very, very transgressive, even when people's intentions are not the best, even when they are really fundamentally anti-heroes in a lot of ways, there is still this undercurrent of friendship.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, no less a personage than the New Yorker called the show a Comden and Green for the Instagram age, and I wish I was making that up. I wish I had a satirical mindset to come up with the perfect New Yorker comment about the show. Comden and Green. But that's actually the place where I also read Amy Poehler saying about the show that it's something you don't see on TV. Confident, sexually active, self-effacing women, period, girlfriends who love each other most. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Okay, so it gets compared to Girls because it's a comedy and there are ovaries, and that's pretty much it. For a lot of reasons, this show's sensibility has a lot more in common with Louis. The thing about Girls that I like a lot, that's about the hypocrisy of these relationships. These are young women who profess how much they love each other and how deep friendships they have, and yet their actions belie it constantly. That's the tension of that show. This show is about exactly the opposite. As Margaret mentioned, this is about that bond. And I think it's really smart. If this was the show that was explained to me that the show was, like it's just stoners in New York City, entitled stoners in New York City doing a lot of drugs and fart jokes. The same issue I had with High Maintenance. That's not what the show is. Yes, there's elements of all those things I just mentioned. But it's a lot more subtle than that, and the dynamic is fascinating. So you've got Ilana, who is the free spirit, the more narcissistic, the more a monster. But it's important that you have Abby. One of the reasons she's such good friends with Ilana is that she admires that freedom, and yet she herself is wracked with self-doubt. She is slightly more square. One of my favorite scenes from the premiere of the second season is the scene where they go into Bed Bath & Beyond. And
oh my God, that's such a great scene.
It's such a great scene because Abby is there among her people. She knows these people so well because she's a nerd for housewares. And Ilana, who spends most of the show acting out, is stuck in that scene reacting. And she's just as funny as she is when she's acting out because the dynamics between these two women shift as they do in real life. I love the show a lot.
And it's interesting. I mean, I've heard it now compared to Louis, which I think is fair, and it's less earnest than Louis.
Yeah.
There are similarities to Girls, but I think the show that it's most closely aligned with actually is Curb Your Enthusiasm, where Curb Your Enthusiasm is about rich people trying to avoid responsibility and getting into trouble because of it. This is about incredibly poor people trying to avoid responsibility and getting in trouble because of it. I think, in a way, I think its closest spiritual mirror is actually Curb Your Enthusiasm.
The reason I went back to Louis is because there is a note of surrealism that creeps into the series every so often. The third episode of the first season where Abby has to sign for a package and then must go to the FedEx distribution center, which is basically on Governor's Island. That is one of my favorite experiences of TV in the past year.
I would counter both of you and say that the show that it's most like is Spaced, which is a little BBC series. That's an early work from Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, Nick Frost, and Jessica Stevenson, nay Hines, or Hines, nay Stevenson. Either way, that's a very underwatched show, but a really wonderful show that has the same kind of lived-in dynamics of what it's like to be sort of a slacker 20-something with very little money, and the same kind of flights of fancy into surrealism that are carried off like just perfectly.
The point that Amy Poehler was making about this show, which is it is the rare show that is about women who are unself-conscious about their sex lives for the most part. It's not a source of angst just to have a sex
life. Or shame.
Or shame.
Right.
I think the fact that the friendship is so paramount is a really lovely quality because I agree that very often shows about female friendship are laced with an underlying sense of competition or deep-seated hostility that takes something away from the show. With that said, I wish I liked it more.
Okay, go ahead.
I really enjoyed watching about two episodes of this show. And then I kind of felt like I had seen it. I have not seen all of the first season. I have seen some of the first season and then maybe half. And then the premiere of the second season. But the more I watched it, the more I felt like, yes, I've seen this. I would have enjoyed this as like a shortish feature.
A web series.
Well, right. And of course, the show comes from a web series that ran a while ago, actually, 2009 to 2011, right. I believe. And for one thing, this show is going uphill with me because I do get quickly bored with pot jokes. Mm-hmm. And I completely relate to what you were saying, that it's not really about the pot jokes. But like the thing that you used to say about Friday Night Lights, when people would say it's not about football and you would say it's about football.
It's like, about football.
This does require you to be able to roll with a lot of pot jokes. Mm-hmm. I am in no way offended by that. I am always bored with that. I am bored with it when Seth Rogen does it. I am bored with it when really anybody does it. I'm bored with it when stand-up comedians do it. It is my least favorite part of any stand-up routine. And this is something Stephen and I have talked about, that the kind of the most boring part to me tends to be the diversion into jokes about drugs. Not because I'm offended, but because I'm bored. Yeah. I don't find it interesting. And for me, that is certainly not the entirety of the show, but no. it is a big component, and it is something that you're going to run into not just sometimes, but kind of over and over and over.
Well, yeah, what I often say about drug humor is it's an experience that is unique to you, and
right.
thus it's a little alienating to yeah. watch it made into humor because your experience with it,
yeah.
I'm not a drug guy. I don't hook into that. And if I were a drug guy, my experience would probably be different from
yeah.
yours. I will say I like the show. I think it's uneven. I watched all of the first season but have not seen the first episode of the second season.
Yeah.
But I watched all 10 episodes more or less in a binge to prepare for this event up in New York City.
Uh-huh.
First of all, watching them in a big cluster, the stakes are a little lower. And I think if I were tuning in week after week, it would be a different experience. The fact that the show is a little looser and a little, I don't want to say flimsier, but you know, the plots are not always incredibly in-depth.
Mm-hmm.
Having the stakes lowered by watching them in one big flood takes away some of the spots that I thought didn't work as well as others.
Yeah.
One of the things I admire about it is that you know when they're plotting out a season, it must come up because there's basically just the two main characters and people surrounding them, that one of the dynamics they must be tempted to do is that one of these people throws the other under a bus for X, Y, or Z reason. The girls' approach. And you know, because of the sensibility of the series, that that is always going to be off the table. I mean, they might do it sometime, but mm-hmm. it just doesn't feel like this show.
Yeah.
And so, Linda, let me just recommend the last episode of the first season,
yes.
episode number 10, where they go to a restaurant. The way in is a bunch of drug jokes. But the core of it, the heart of it, if you will, is just so much bigger, so
I
much
know,
better.
I know. And the thing is, it makes me feel like such a rotten person because I...
well, it should.
Well,
no,
here,
you are.
No, monster.
That,
well, here's... Okay, get out of our podcast, Linda. Here's how I think about it. If I were designing the menu at a restaurant, right, I would include a really satisfying, awesome vegetarian option, right? Because
mm-hmm.
I want it to be there because it's part of having a full menu. If you didn't have it, I would say you don't have a complete menu, right? You're leaving things off. At the same time, I wouldn't order it probably. And this is a show for me that when I hear Amy Poehler talk about it and when I hear Margaret talk about it, I'm so happy it's there. I'm so happy they're making it. It's just not my bag.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the same way about this show that I do about certain other things where you feel yourself divide as like an observer of the world of television and what the world of television really needs and suffers from a lack of. And part of that is to recognize that the world of television suffers an absence of things that are not for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this is the kind of show I'm really glad they're making. I'm really glad that you guys love it. I'm especially glad that Margaret loves it and relates to it and feels so welcome in it. But I do feel like they have a couple of things that they go back to over and over and over again that are not comedy beats that are for me. And I don't feel any great desire to watch it.
I understand that. I would replace your reference to drug jokes and plug in fart and poop jokes, of which there are.
And that's the other thing. And I haven't mentioned that yet, but it's kind of the same thing with this show, that there's more of that than is ever going to be up my personal alley. That sounds gross. That sounds gross in the context of this show. If you watch the show, the up my alley thing just sounds really disgusting. But
I do want to talk about one thing that I particularly love about this show that I wasn't necessarily expecting going in, which is this is a show set in New York from the perspective of two people who are not really of New York. One of them grew up on Long Island and kind of made occasional journeys into the city. One grew up in, I believe, Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Wayne, Pennsylvania.
Thank you. I knew it was a W.
Uh-huh.
And the show really comes at New York from an outsider's perspective, where these people are immersed in the city, but it's not a mash note to the city. They manage to pick out things that are incredibly gross about the city and mine them for humor in ways that I really enjoy. You know, like, and some of it is
there's a gag in the subway in the second season opener that's like that.
Yeah,
that any person who's ever been on a subway would relate to. Also.
Yeah, they understand what is worst about the worst possible bus ride in New York City. What is worse about the worst possible picking up a package in New York City? Mm-hmm. What is worse about the worst possible walking down the street in New York City? And without it being apartment brokers in New York City, I found that an interesting take on the city. And one that I didn't expect from a show that's very much like young people getting by.
Yeah.
Right. I think its virtue, for me, is that it's specific, not insular. I mean, obviously it's insular to a certain point because it's not Linda's bag. But for me, I mean, I'm not especially like either character, but I feel very much like both of them. And the things that are going on in their life feel very real to me, partly because they're just so expertly observed. And the jokes, for me, can be hit or miss, but the relationships are always just such a joy to spend time with. And not just Alana and Abby, also Alana and her sort of on-again, off-again boyfriend, yep. Lincoln. There's no relationship that's equivalent to that on TV that I can think of.
That's Hannibal Buress, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Who's one of the show's greatest
assets. Yeah.
So good.
Well, the show is pitched a certain way, and then he comes in and dries it out.
And sweetens it up a little bit, too.
He does. He's very, very lovable in a strange way.
It's true. It's true. And I think, you know, you mentioned earlier, and it really bears repeating, that one of the show's real strengths, and another reason why I'm really glad it exists, and I'm really glad they're making it, is that it is a show about young people in New York that does not assume a level of wealth that makes it fantasy off the top. They do try to figure out how to get money. Even the act of them saying, like, we can do this to get this much money and this to get this much money, even that calculus happening is, you know, not seen all that often.
They do a lot with the economic situation they're in. I mean, the Alana character is, there's a great scene where she's ducking out of her, like, kind of crummy job to take a temp job. Like, as the temporary office manager of the temp agency, which she then ducks out on to walk dogs and manages to shirk duties at all three jobs. The bit of the Abby character who has the unseen roommate, where the only presence of the roommate is the awful boyfriend who never leaves. And these are very much experiences that friends of mine who are scraping by in the city go through. That stuff feels very, very authentic and lived
in. There's a lot about it that I like. I just wish that I wanted to watch it more, and I feel strange about
Linda,
it.
Nothing that's really good is ever for everyone.
That's true. And I think what you said about specificity speaks to this, like, mm-hmm. that it's the difference between specificity and relatability. You're not necessarily saying it's relatable to me in a direct way, but the specificity of it makes it feel human, and the humanity of it makes it feel real to you, you know?
Right.
Well, I suspect that many of you out there are Broad City viewers. I would love to hear what you have to say. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/monkeyc. So the other thing we were going to talk about today, because we have Margaret on the line, we thought we should talk about books. And then we got talking about high school required reading. Now, I don't know what other people were required to read in high school. And this is not just high school, but also junior high, I think, should be included. I mean, because that goes back to, like, when you get into junior high, you get into your Johnny Tremaine.
Sure.
Your Animal Farm. Mm-hmm. I am going to open this conversation by making an argument, as Glenn would say, I essay, that high school required reading is the most even-handed combination of positive and negative of all the things that people do in high school. Because for me, I took one trimester of contemporary literature when I was a senior in high school, and we read, for example, Blood of the Lamb by Peter DeVries. That's a funny, interesting, weird book that kind of gets you into an actual contemporary literature kind of place. Mm-hmm. I also read a lot of stuff that I don't really care that I read, like The Old Man and the Sea. I understand it's a classic, but I didn't get it. And I might get it now. If I read it now, I might get it now. But at the time, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Fish for like a gazillion pages.
No, see, this is the problem. I think both The Old Man and the Sea and Ethan Frome are two of the most wronged books by English curriculums throughout this country because
they
are books that are very short. that no one under 40 should ever read.
Now, she's a librarian. She says this with a love of books. Now, I want to let Margaret explain why she says this.
I feel like if you bring up this book in a group of any people of any age who've done required reading, you will get an impassioned, violent, hateful response against either one or both. Because they're like between 80 and 120 pages. But they are stories. In one case, The Old Man and the Sea, it is an old man goes out, tries to catch a fish, fails, Jesus imagery. And the other one...
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry. I'm going to spoil these extremely old books right now, everyone. Just be prepared. Mm-hmm. Ethan Frome, it's like old man, mysterious, very sad New England village, secret history, sled to death unsuccessfully with his one true love.
This is great. I feel like I've read it.
Yeah.
This is better than Cliff Notes. Yeah. This is, okay. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, so you can screw up a kid for life. Mm-hmm. This is the power you have when you create a high school reading list, because you have in your hand the power to determine whether or not they're going to see reading and books and writing, by that extension, as A, something that is an object to be admired from behind glass that you must, you know, think about and put into context as if you're going on a very long but perhaps rewarding museum trip, or if it's a living thing, a conversation that you can join. A lot of the stuff I was required to read was intended to be from column B, but it was actually column A. So they push Catcher in the Rye at you thinking it's a kid.
Mm-hmm. You'll be able to understand.
They push a separate piece. Good Lord. That book bored me. And it was actually my first experience realizing what sentimentality is, why something doesn't work. And I also just like, just kiss already, guys. Dude, just kiss. That's what it is. I also think that there is, you know, kids are reading. Kids have always read. And what are kids actually reading for fun? They're reading Harry Potter, or possibly they were, and maybe not anymore, but things like His Dark Materials, A Series of Unfortunate Events, The Hunger Games. These are books, if I can discern a through line, have an element of the fantastic. And when I looked at some of the high school reading lists, and I did some searching around today to try to find them, and what was astonishing to me, Margaret, is how much those lists don't seem to have changed, even in an era, even 30 years later, that there's still your Animal Farms, your 1984s, your Scarlet Letters, your Babbitt.
Oh, Scarlet Letter.
But Babbitt, let's talk about Babbitt for a second. Babbitt is a searing satire of the sort of social striving of the 1920s middle class. And I heard that.
How relevant to today's
Exactly.
Youth.
I heard that and I was like, oh, satire. And then it's like, ooh, boy, this book. Take that, the JCs. You know, like, why is this, why is a 14-year-old reading about this?
Right.
And, yeah, you can take that too far. Obviously, now, I am going to come down, I'm going to say something very controversial, which is I think the kids should read Shakespeare. Yeah, sure. I said it. Call me Harold Bloom, if you will. But, I mean, man, like, it shouldn't all be easy.
No, right? And I took a trimester of Shakespeare as well. I'm really glad I did.
It's a skill set. First of all, there's a cultural component to all these stories from Shakespeare.
Right.
And to be able to read that poetry and to find it remotely rewarding is just something you have under your belt that you're going to need in life.
One reason that I'm actually glad that I read Shakespeare in high school is that at one point a couple of years ago, Trey Graham was saying, which character was what? And I go, Mercutio? And I was right.
Yeah.
And I felt there's this swell of reading literary knowledge, and it was nice. And I actually loved reading Shakespeare in high school. The one I resented in the same class was Chaucer.
Yeah.
I found Chaucer very, very frustrating.
I just heard the sigh from Margaret. It's great not having Margaret in the room in only one way, which is that I get to hear her sigh on the mic, and that's how I know how she's feeling.
So, Margaret, are there new things that have been added to the canon? Are there things that have... Are we still talking about Gatsby, an American tragedy, God help me?
As your, two-trink pony, highly literate, relatively young.
Yeah.
Right.
I can tell you that the books you're speaking about were the books that formed the majority of my high school literary experience, but that is 15 years ago now. In terms of whether there's been a lot of movement since then, I think it really depends on which school you're looking at. So I don't think there's been a lot of movement in, say, your literature AP coursework.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're at a school like the school Linda went to, you know, a small Quaker school, I bet you're getting really advanced, really interesting classes. And I imagine if you're at a school like mine, you know, a magnet school deeply enamored of its past in the 17th century, like, there hasn't been a lot of movement and there will never be a lot of movement.
That's really interesting. I was thinking about this the other day and I was thinking, well, look, I did not come into adulthood as a big serious novel reader. I am a popular novel reader. I'm a kind of a genre fiction reader, much more than I am a literary fiction reader when it comes to novels. And I've been, you know, very open about that. There have been exceptions to that, but that is sort of how I came into adulthood. And I went back and I tried to think, like, am I going to try to blame this on school and required reading and all that stuff? And up to a point, there is some truth to the fact that I came to think of it as work. But the other thing that is really, that I think was helpful for me to remember was to look back on the reading that I remember being recommended to me individually by teachers. And those things were important. I think I was in fifth grade when the librarian gave me Rebecca and said, you should try reading this book. And I read Gone with the Wind not long after that. And she gave me Rebecca for me personally. And she was right. And it was a really good idea because it is a serious book. It's a different world than the one you live in and so forth. And the other one was a sophomore year teacher, English teacher, who told me to read Nikki Giovanni poetry and said to me, I think you would really like this. I think this would really resonate with you. And I loved it and I still read it. And I still remember the effect of it when I first started reading it. So I think part of the problem with required reading, it's very easy to kind of dump on these canonical lists. You know, there's no substitute for something that is recommended to you with the understanding that not all kids need to read the same things in an ideal universe, but that not every school has time to assign books to kids individually.
And not every school has the funding for a good school librarian either.
Right, of course.
I mean, I do think, though, that the literary fiction community's disdain for genre is either reflected in or perhaps has its roots in the high school reading list. Because most of these books that I came across when I was doing this search belong to a certain kitchen sink literalism with no elements of the fantastic. I mean, yeah, okay, Gatsby has some imagery in it, got some green lights and ash heaps, but that's
sure
not what
does.
I'm talking about. I mean, when I was hungering for, like, if you look at the books that I was reading for fun, I was hungering for something beyond just, you know, people looking at each other and having conversations in drawing rooms. I was hungering for The Hobbit. I read many times The Silmarillion. Now, Linda Holmes, if you were bored by The Hobbit, The Silmarillion is the prehistory of Middle Earth, and it is like reading the King James Bible translated from the Finnish. It is like reading Bullfinch's mythology with umlauts. It is stultifying. It's fusty. It's tweety. I ate it up with a big spoon because it was not what I was getting from Catcher in the Rye and Huck Finn and Death of a Salesman and the jungle.
But again, this is specific to you. And that's what I'm saying is, like, so much depends on the individual nature of the kid. And I don't want to just say, like, the answer is for everybody to just read what they want to read. I like the idea of challenging kids. I like the idea of pushing them to go forward.
Glenn, you mentioned The Jungle. I read The Jungle and really was fascinated with it. And when I think about the books that hit me when I was in high school, I think about The Jungle, I think about Roots, and I think about, like, Tale of Two Cities. Mm-hmm. And, like, what all of those books...
Oh, my God, I can't believe you said Tale of Two Cities. We'll have to talk in a second.
Okay. What all of those books have in common is that they are about past struggle. You know, I hooked into them partly as an angst-ridden teenager, and in part out of empathy for what people outside of my world had gone through. And I was, you know, I was an earnest high schooler.
Sure.
I think of those as very important books for people to read in order to contextualize contemporary human tragedy.
Right. That's where we differ. You had empathy. I did not.
And I think maybe the approach is the problem and not always the material. Glenn, you touched on this earlier, which is sort of like, are you in a museum or is it a conversation? Are you encouraged to approach these books decorously, or are you encouraged to approach them boisterously? So, like, you mentioned Tale of Two Cities, Stephen. A Tale of Two Cities, when I read it at 14, almost ruined Charles Dickens for me forever. Because you meet the main female character, you meet Lucy Manette 50 pages in, and the first thing she does is faint. And, you know, I'm not a fainter. I just felt like hurling the book across the room. I was furious with it. And my relationship to Charles Dickens improved infinitely in college, where I owned my books and I was allowed to make sarcastic margin notes to my heart's content. So as soon as I could talk back to him, like, everything was fine. Chuck and I, we've worked it out. Great Expectations is one of my favorite books. I couldn't do it where I was just supposed to be receiving these words and being awed by them. I had to have this sense that I was allowed to go in and monkey around and have my own opinions and feelings too, which I did not really get in high school.
No, that's a great point.
Yeah,
that's
and if I had done that, I just would have like told Chuck to stop beheading people I like.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, you can't go through a conversation about this quote unquote canon without acknowledging that one of the issues with it is always inclusiveness of different kinds of people and people with different kinds of experiences, and that, you know, one of the things that gives the canon with some people a bad reputation is that it has tended to be a very white, very male place where only certain experiences really are welcome and really are reflected.
But aren't more high school librarians open, at least notionally, nominally, to things like YA and comics?
Well, you're talking about librarians and curriculum are two very different things.
Yeah.
You know, the person who recommended Rebecca to Linda, that's not necessarily the person who is teaching her English class, and the considerations that that person has to take into play when constructing their syllabus is totally different.
Right.
But yeah, like high school librarians are going to be giving kids graphic novels and YA.
Right.
And I'm sure a lot of high schools are also assigning them in curriculum. Rainbow Rowell, our friend, has had her book Eleanor and Park taught at a number of high schools. So many English teachers are assigning YA graphic novels a wider range of materials. But I think the backbone of it is, as it always will be, white dudes.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's any progress on that front as somebody who observes this a little more closely than I do? Do you feel like the diversification of that school age canon has changed any?
We can speak even just to my experience. So I was assigned reading in 10th grade, Not Without Laughter by Langston Hughes, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, and The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. Those may or may not have been on curriculums when you guys were in school, and I can name them all so quickly because they were really immersive, delightful, enjoyable reading experiences for me.
That's more what was going on for me curriculum-wise once I got to college.
Yeah.
Right.
I read The Bluest Eye, and I think I read some other Toni Morrison as well.
I definitely read Toni Morrison in my literature AP class as well. So there's definitely been, the whiteness of the canon has been diluted. The maleness of the canon has been diluted. And then in addition to that, I think there is a lot more openness to assigning materials written specifically for teen audiences. Like Walter Dean Myers is a huge school reading item for high schoolers in schools where they're very conscious about trying to give kids mirrors of their own experience.
That's really interesting. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, on Sunday afternoon, my Green Bay Packers, I can't, you know what? It just, my heart was pulverized into a slurry of smashed atoms.
Yeah.
And ever since, I've been trying to think of something that's been making me happy this week. An announcement came through today being Tuesday, that the Bjork album that's supposed to come out in March is actually out now. But that's only because it's been leaked, which means that jerks. So I can't really say that that's something that's been making me happy. So what I will say is that we got word today at the NPR Music Office, the entries just closed for our Tiny Desk Concert Contest, where bands and musicians all over the country were, like unsigned, unknown bands and artists from all over the country, were urged to submit video of them performing one song behind a desk. And the winner will get to, you know, perform a thing in Austin, and they'll get to perform at the Tiny Desk. We got word today, more than 5,000.
What?
Entries.
Wow.
What?
That's so
that
exciting.
Is so many bands. It's really hard to break into the music industry.
Now, what is making me incredibly happy, not happy enough to soothe my poor battered psyche from the football loss, is that I am not a judge in that competition.
Otherwise, we know that it would be, as I was mocking you about recently, a woman who sounds like she's singing sitting under a mushroom.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Anyway, look for that contest to unfold without me.
I'm sorry. All right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
If you are listening to this on Friday the 23rd, when this podcast drops, as the kids say, you should be advised that Kyle Kinane's new stand-up special premieres on Comedy Central tonight at midnight. It's called I Liked His Old Stuff Better. I haven't seen it yet, but this is Kyle Kinane. He's dependable. He's funny. He's good. You're going to like it. It's going to be great. I guarantee. I also guarantee, because I have seen it, Wyatt Cenac's special, Brooklyn, is now on Netflix. It's hilarious. It's great. And NPR's own Ophira Eisenberg has an album out, a stand-up album out called Bangs. It's also great. So those are three things to look forward to this weekend.
Yay. Fantastic. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Margaret H. Hula Hoop Willison. What is making you happy?
The H is for hula hoop.
yes.
One, that myth being spread even further is making me ecstatic.
It's true. I think that was originally courtesy of our friend Jessica Daniels.
Yeah.
I stole it from her. While speculating about what the H in Margaret H. Willison was for, Jessica said hula hoop, and I have run with it. Anyway, hula hoop. What is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is that this airs on the 23rd. On the 28th, I leave for Chicago, where I will be attending the American Library Association's midwinter meeting, a.k.a. one of the highlights of my social calendar. But this is important to the Pop Culture Happy Hour audience because it is also where the Youth Media Awards are announced. Obviously, like, the top lines of that are the Newbery Award and the Caldecott Award. But what's important to know is that those are just two awards out of maybe 15 that are announced that day, all of which are for really excellent things. My two favorites of this list are the Morris Award, which is for debut YA titles. And that list is really special to me because they announce a short list of 5 potential winners, and then one is selected. So you can monkey around and read a bunch of them and find new authors to get really excited about. And then the other one is the Alex Award, which is given to 10 books published for adults with high teen appeal, which is another way of saying 10 books published for adults Margaret might actually like.
Yeah, you know, I like to think of myself as having
high teen appeal.
Extremely high teen appeal.
Steven just spit water out of his nose if you're wondering how much high teen appeal he thinks I have. High teen appeal.
And I know that these awards are great because I found 2 books from those awards that I want to recommend right now, which are Serafina by Rachel Hartman, which won the Morris Award in 2012, and Tell the Wolves I'm Home by Carol Riefke Brunt, which won the Alex Award in 2012. So I'm going to be live tweeting this from the ceremony on Monday the 2nd. And you should definitely check it out and visit the ALA to see what won. Oh, it's a great way to get diverse titles, too. We gave awards to African-American books, books about the Hispanic-American experience, books about gay and lesbian teenagers, books about disabled teenagers. It's great. Check it out.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much, Margaret H. Willison. I got 3 things making me happy this week. First of all, last week at this time, we made a little request. The Pop Culture Happy Hour family. We said we got a survey, and we said, go fill out the survey. So we announced the survey, and without getting into the specifics of numbers and zeros and all that stuff, they expect a certain response, which they thought was going to take a couple weeks. They got it in a couple hours. And because there were a certain number of free responses where people got to write at length about their feelings, it was about to turn into an amount of data that I think they were maybe going to be a little overwhelmed by. So
feeling's always bad.
The survey got closed. And I know that it was sad for some of you who wanted to pass on your suggestions to us. But I just personally want to give my heartfelt thanks to the Pop Culture Happy Hour audience for always shocking everyone at this here place with your enthusiasm, your engagement. People care about stuff like that these days. And when you demonstrate how much you care about the show, that helps us. And so even if you didn't get to fill it out, the fact that you were part of that gigantic crush of excitement was really great. And we appreciate it. Second. So we're having another live event. Those of you who have been to our live shows before have seen our kind of big 2-part live event. We tape the show and then we have a big second half. This is the streamlined version. What we're really inviting people to this time is much more just a taping of the podcast. We will come in, we will tape the show, and then everybody will go home. And so you will not be out quite so late. We will not be torturing radio personalities, as I sometimes do. This is really just come watch us tape the show. We're going to do it as much like we normally do.
We're actually going to torture one radio personality.
It's true, because our pal Bob Mondello will be there for with us, because the one that we are going to tape in front of this audience is our annual Oscars Omnibus. That's our show where we talk about all of the nominees and we run down our various favorites and non-favorites, and we throw in all kinds of stuff about different nominations that happened and didn't happen. And it's always a really fun show, so we're going to tape it live. Now, the taping is going to be on February 17th at 7 o'clock p.m. here at NPR headquarters in Studio One. That's where we've had a couple of our live events in the past. Tickets are going to go on sale on February 3rd, 2/3, February 3rd at noon, and that will be at events.npr.org. Get that address? events.npr.org. Again, noon on February 3rd, we will have our tickets going on sale, and the event is February 17th at 7 with our pal Bob Mondello. Come and watch us tape the show. And we're going to do it, as I said, as much like we normally do as possible.
And with a reduced ticket price.
Because
it is not going to be quite the spectacular.
The tickets are $15, and with that, you get access to a cash bar starting at, I believe, 6 o'clock.
Not every day you can get access to a cash bar.
So, you know, pretty cool. We hope to see lots of you there. I will be looking forward to it. And so that is the second thing that is making me happy. And the third thing making me happy, because I do not want all of the things making me happy to be about the show. Mm-hmm. This week, Monday of this week that we are taping this, marked the debut of Larry Wilmore's The Nightly Show, which is the successor to Stephen Colbert. It is, as you can imagine, a companion piece to The Daily Show. My first memory of seeing Larry Wilmore was on The Office, on the episode. It was like the second or third episode of The Office, and they had the seminar about racial sensitivity. And his name was Mr. Brown, which Michael Scott, of course, said, I'm not calling you that. That's a test. He said, no, that's my name. Anyway, and he wrote The PJs. There's a great episode of WTF that was not that long ago that Larry Wilmore was on. He's a super fascinating guy to me. He's been on The Daily Show for a long time as the senior black correspondent. All around, very strong candidate for a job like this. And he is not another white dude, as he pointed out in the opening to his very own first show. He is following a format that is a little bit different. He's got an anchor desk part like the other ones do, but then he opens it up and he's got a big panel discussion. I don't know if any of you know this about me, but I like a roundtable discussion. And I really look forward to seeing kind of where they're going to go with that. I think the panel part needs a little bit of work and cleanup, but they're doing very good work on that show based on one episode, which is what I've seen as we tape this. It's a good show. I'm happy to see him with a show every night. I think that's a really good step for Comedy Central for a ton of reasons. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And you can follow Margaret, as we said, at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katzeff at Mike Katzeff. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Linda.
Oh, thank you for joining us from Boston, in particular, Miss Margaret. And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's newest show, Invisibilia. Your expectations can have a surprising effect on the people around you. And on the newest Invisibilia, you'll hear from neuroscientists who explain the profound effect others' expectations can have on your physiology, and from the blind man who says expectations have helped him see. From some of the people who created This American Life and Radiolab, subscribe to Invisibilia on iTunes now. The new episode drops January 23rd.